WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Bush has been widely praised for his plan to reduce our nuclear arsenal. The plan is to eliminate about 2,400 short-range nuclear weapons on land and sea in Europe and Asia. Long-range bombers and some long-range missiles have been taken off 24-hour alert. The president's plan is considered a breakthrough in arms control because it was done independent of any negotiations with the Soviet Union. My guest Michael Clare applauds the president. But Clare says scaling back nuclear weapons aimed at the Soviet Union doesn't mean the American military plans on scaling back its weaponry for fighting wars in other parts of the world. Clare is an associate professor at Hampshire College and directs the Five College Program in Peace and World Securities. He's also the defense correspondent for The Nation. Michael Clare told me he doesn't think the president's plan is exactly about the search for peace.
I do think, however, that it's about the search for stability and security in a very turbulent world and a way of protecting ourselves against possible accidental or unintended nuclear conflicts for which we have no defenses. So there's a security consciousness, but not, I think, an active search for peace.
What do you think the president's motivations were in the arms reduction plan?
I think there are several motivations. One, of course, is presidential politics, and maybe you'd like to talk about that. But from a military point of view, I would say the principal motivation is to deal with a very serious emerging problem that we're facing. And that is, with the breakup of the Soviet Union into its constituent republics, there's a real fear that the very large arsenal of Soviet tactical nuclear weapons, of which there are 10 or 12,000 of them scattered across the Soviet Union and at sea, will fall into hands that are not at the control of Moscow or not under centralized control and can be used for all kinds of nefarious or unpredictable purposes in local wars between the republics or in regional conflicts in Eastern Europe. There are many nightmare scenarios one could think of when you recognize that these tactical nuclear warheads are scattered and not at this point under safe control. And I think that what primarily motivated the president was to find a shortcut to get those weapons under control.
The weapons that will be cut back are largely tactical as opposed to strategic nuclear weapons. What's the difference?
Primarily here, it's what we're aiming the weapons at. Strategic nuclear weapons are weapons aimed at the homeland of the other superpower. Our ICBMs and bombers aimed at the Soviet Union and Soviet equivalent weapons. Tactical nuclear weapons, on the other hand, are weapons aimed at the other country's military forces in the field, large tank armies in Europe, aircraft carriers and naval warships at sea, submarines, aircraft, that sort of thing. It would be easy to think that there are also much smaller weapons, but that's not always the case. Some of these tactical nuclear weapons, so-called, are more powerful in their destructive impact than the Hiroshima and Nagasaki weapons. And that's why it's so worrisome to Washington that these weapons and the Soviet stockpile are not now under assured control. And the fear is, I think, that down the road, with the breakup of the Soviet Union, with the possible disappearance from the scene of Mr. Gorbachev, that these things will fall out of centralized control and be used in unpredictable ways.
So the president is hoping that by him cutting back tactical weapons, that the Soviets will do that too. What signs do we have so far? Are the Soviets likely to reciprocate?
I think that probably the president has had some prior conversations with Mr. Gorbachev, or perhaps Secretary Baker did when he was meeting with Gorbachev. Possibly they have some assurances that that will be the case. But I think that it was necessary for the United States to act first, and that's the bold aspect of the president's plan. Up until now, we've always maintained that any arms reductions with the Soviets had to be the result of long-term arms control negotiations with reciprocal agreements and verification and compliance and inspections and so on. And I think the calculation in Washington is that if we followed that route this time around, it would be too late. It would take 5 years or 10 years to have that kind of agreement. And by that time, these weapons could be scattered all across the earth. So I think that the president concluded that the only way to get Gorbachev to act quickly is if we first announced our decision to get rid of these weapons and therefore make it easier for Mr. Gorbachev to make a similar move on his own without looking like he's giving in to the West or, you know, somehow abandoning Soviet defenses. So in that sense, I think this was a very bold move on the part of President Bush.
Do you think that we're compromising our security by getting rid of these weapons?
In no way. I would argue, and I think many security analysts would argue likewise, that these weapons, in fact, were dangerous to our security. You have to understand that they represented a stepping stone between conventional war, large-scale conventional wars like we might see in Europe, and all-out strategic nuclear war between the superpowers. These are the weapons that would be the nuclear weapons that would be used first in battle, and therefore they're very close to the front of the battlefield. They're at ships at sea. They're at risk, and they're very easy to conceive of them being used in haste or in panic quickly, and therefore igniting a global nuclear war that nobody wanted. So I think by getting rid of them, we're actually making ourselves a lot safer than we would be otherwise.
Does the president's arms reduction plan indicate a shift in the American military posture?
I do believe that the president's plan represents the result of rethinking about America's security policy. You might put it this way. Up until now, we've been preparing for World War III, a global all-out war with the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. That's no longer a credible scenario. No one believes that that kind of war will occur. And I think that the people in the Pentagon, the senior officers in the Department of Defense and the White House are beginning to think about the wars of the future, World War IV, if you will, with the future threats to America's global power. And I think what they're saying is we need to get rid of this obsolete, unnecessary weaponry of World War III in order to persuade Congress and the American public to finance the buildup for the wars of the future, for this hypothetical World War IV. And I think that underlies, to a great extent, the president's plan, even if it's not explicitly in his speech.
So finally, you think this isn't about disarmament, but about a change in arms?
Exactly. This is about rearming the United States for future wars. It's to clear the ground, clear the air, so that the president can come before Congress and ask for funds for whole new types of weapons and new generations of weapons so that we could be prepared for wars in the 21st century. And he's planning to ask for very large sums of money for these new kinds of weapons.
What do you think the military strategists are conceiving of as a possible scenario for World War IV? And that's how you describe it, as World War IV.
Well, I think that what the military is thinking about for the 21st century is for the emergence of new regional powers equipped with nuclear weapons and ICBMs and large modern conventional forces. And I don't think one could pick a particular country, but I think that one could speculate about the emergence of China or India or Brazil or Argentina in 25 or 30 years equipped with very large arsenals of these weapons. That certainly was what was behind the conflict in the Persian Gulf, the fear that Iraq could be a major military power in the 21st century if we didn't take care of that now. And I think it's this thinking, preparing for conflict with the emerging superpowers of the 21st century, that the new military strategy is aimed at.
This kind of war that you're thinking of as the possible 21st century war, this is what would be called a middle intensity conflict, yes?
Middle intensity if it's confined to one region, in the sense that we would be in combat with a regional power like Iraq, like Syria, like Brazil, rather than on a global scale, which would be a high-intensity conflict like that with the Soviet Union. But it is this sort of middle-range type of war that the Pentagon is focusing on right now, both in its military planning and its weapons development.
Whereas in the 70s and 80s, I guess we were more geared for either an all-out World War III or for low-intensity conflict.
Exactly. I think in the 1970s and 80s, we were looking at both the high end of the military spectrum, all-out war with the USSR, and the low end, guerrilla wars, insurgencies, proxy wars in Central America, that sort of thing. Now the focus is on the mid-range of conflicts, with emerging regional powers that might have some nuclear chemical weapons and some ballistic missiles, but are not as powerful as the Soviet Union was at its peak.
So what kind of weapons do you think are the weapons that American military strategists are thinking of for this kind of mid-range, middle-intensity war?
A combination of things. They certainly need long-range power projection forces, that is, forces that allow the U.S. to project power great distances without the use of intermediate bases. That would include things like aircraft carriers, submarines, amphibious assault ships, the new C-17 intercontinental transport plane, the B-2 bomber, which could fly intercontinental distances, weapons that could be based in the United States and carry a very potent military power to greatly distant locations. That's part of it. The other part, of course, is the high-tech weaponry that would allow inferior numbers of American forces to prevail against much larger numbers of indigenous forces in these areas that we might go to war. So it's a combination of projection forces and high-tech conventional weapons.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Clare. He's an associate professor at Hampshire College, where he directs the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies. He's also the author of The American Arms Supermarket and co-editor of Low-Intensity Warfare. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Clare is my guest. He's the defense correspondent for The Nation. The president has called for weapons reduction in Eastern Europe, but there hasn't been any call for a cutback in the proposed strategic defense initiative, Star Wars. Would Star Wars fit into this scenario for, you know, the 21st century war?
Very much so, although I think the White House exaggerates the threat. Part of what they're responding to here is the fact that a number of third world countries, including Israel and India and Pakistan, Brazil and Argentina, have begun development of intermediate range and even long range ballistic missiles that would theoretically allow them in the 21st century to fire primitive chemical weapons or primitive nuclear weapons, I should say, and possibly chemical weapons at the United States. And that would be the greatest fear that we might have to face from these mid-intensity wars, these regional conflicts. So Star Wars, in its emerging form, its scaled-back form, would give the United States an absolute insurance policy against that kind of risk. Now, I don't think that that risk is very great, and most other analysts feel the same way. But clearly, the president feels that investing huge amounts of money in these kind of defenses would be to our advantage.
Where do nuclear weapons fit in to the new military strategy?
I think, again, it's as an insurance policy to make sure that no other country will ever arise again that could be militarily superior to the United States, that we would always have one ace in the hand that no one else could duplicate, so that we would always be the number one global power, whether the challenge comes from the Third World or from a rearmed Germany or Japan. This would be the ultimate weapon that we'd have at our disposal to threaten and to intimidate any future rivals. But I don't think they're viewed as actual weapons of war because there'd be no purpose to that.
Do you think that the military strategists are thinking now about what America's military role should be in the world, since the United States is perhaps the only superpower now?
Yes, I think there's a lot of thought being given to America's future military role. In fact, that's the main activity in the Pentagon today, because there's anxiety that the American public now wants to see a genuine peace dividend, a real scaling back of the military so that funds could be used for other purposes. And so the main preoccupation of American strategists today is to find a credible, viable role for the military in the future. And they are generating a variety of scenarios and contingencies, as they call them, that would justify a large military. One of them, obviously, is a new Saddam Hussein, a new regional power-hungry dictator somewhere in the third world who would threaten American interests in some form. And we will undoubtedly continue to maintain a very large military force that could be used for that purpose, at least if the Pentagon has its way. But they're thinking of other contingencies as well, of future upheavals in other parts of the third world, of the sort we saw in Vietnam and in other third world countries in the past. They're worried about drug conflicts or narco-terrorists, as they're called, engaging in large-scale violence. And I think they're conceivably thinking about the emergence of new superpowers in the 21st century, based in Europe, perhaps, or a rearmed Japan or a rearmed China. These are the sorts of things that Pentagon planners spend a lot of time hypothesizing about and building forces to protect against.
With the Cold War over, do you feel that we are much further away now from nuclear war in this world?
I wish I could say that, but I don't believe it's so. I think we're much further away from the nuclear holocaust of the worst doomsday scenarios of the 1960s and 70s and 80s, when we thought of the end of the earth, that all living things would perish in a global nuclear conflagration. I think we're far away from that kind of a nuclear war. But I think the risk of a regional nuclear war fought by regional powers armed with primitive nuclear weapons is increasing because of nuclear proliferation and the breakup of the Soviet Union. I'm thinking of a war between Israel and a nuclear-armed Arab country down the road, or a nuclear war between India and Pakistan, both of which now have significant nuclear weapons capabilities, or a future war between Argentina and Brazil fought with nuclear weapons. That kind of conflict, I think the threat of that is increasing as we look into the future. And it's very troubling that that's the case.
Michael Clare is an associate professor at Hampshire College and director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Securities. He's also the defense correspondent for The Nation.